Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's podcast features Jonathan Anser and his latest book, Bullshit, 50 Fibs That Made South Africa. An outrageous miscellany of lies, myths, untruths, fibs, and fabrications that tell the woeful history of South Africa. Aimed at offending and entertaining everyone in equal measure, this will have South Africans sniggering and spluttering into their porridge. It'll also pique their curiosity. The lies come thick and fast, like a burst sewage pipe. Way, way back, the Europeans discovered South Africa and found a land that was largely uninhabited. No. On the other hand, Africa was a paradise before the settlers pulled in. Not quite. Back in the darkest ages, the 1970s, citizens were told that there were satanic messages if you played the Beatles songs backwards. During the Civil War in Angola, there were no South African troops in the country. National icon Hansie Cronje was a paragon of virtue and integrity. Until he wasn't. And President Nelson Mandela told us that we as a nation were special. Turns out, we aren't. Jonathan Anser has written, after consulting with historians and barflies, a fascinating and witty collection of the lies we've been told, and the lies we've told ourselves. In this episode, Jonathan is in conversation with the remarkable Rebecca Davis, senior journalist at the Daily Maverick and author. Enjoy. Welcome to PageCast. My name is Rebecca Davis, senior journalist at the Daily Maverick, and it is my great pleasure to be in conversation today with Jonathan Anser, veteran journalist, author, media trainer, the author of 6 books now, and the most recent one is the book that we'll be discussing today, Bullshit, 50 Fibs That Made South Africa. Jonathan, welcome. Thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Now, as you know, Jonathan, I had the extraordinary pleasure of reading the audiobook of your actually, book, Bullshit.
Actually, the extraordinary pleasure is ours. So thank you for that. Really.
No, it really was a riot. The book, I can tell everyone listening, is a hoot from start to finish, which is not to say it doesn't have serious elements as well, which we'll talk about. But it is a rollicking good read. And congratulations, basically.
Well, thank you. I'm glad nobody can see I'm blushing here.
Jonathan, tell us a bit about how the book kind of came into being. What was the genesis of the idea?
Well, actually, it wasn't my idea at all. It was Jeremy Berain at Jonathan Ball, and he sort of invited me for a coffee, and he said, I have an idea. And he told me his idea about looking at South Africa's history, but based on the lies we've been told. And I liked that idea very much. I liked the idea of coming at history from a very, very different perspective. Mm. And so I went away and I started writing, and then I started panicking because I'm actually not a historian, although I love history. And it suddenly felt very daunting finding all these lies. And I was trying to get my head around, and must this be peer reviewed? And, you know, it has to be absolutely accurate. And then I got an email from Jeremy maybe a month into the project, and he said, we've been thinking about it, and we thought a good title for the book is Bullshit. And I then, you know, sort of got a bit of a shock. But that actually set the tone, because then it meant that it didn't have to be completely, absolutely sort of historically accurate, although, you know, accuracy is what I've gone for, but I didn't have to be citing academic journals and speaking to professors and going on that sort of research. It meant that I could have a bit of fun.
And it certainly is fun, I must say. I should say as well, though, that I found it an education. Honestly, I really did. I mean, there's so much of the stuff that I'd forgotten, or some stuff that I didn't know about at all. So don't, I think, count yourself out on the popular historian front, because it is, you know, it's genuinely very educational as well. Jonathan, are you particularly drawn to kind of charlatans? Because I'm struck by the fact, you know, you've written about apartheid spies, you've written about Craig Williams, you've obviously written about good people too, mentions in the trenches. But is there something about sort of the con men, the fraudsters, etc., that appeals to you as a subject?
Yeah, very much so. But what I do like about those sorts of stories is when they get their comeuppance. I like a good sort of murder mystery, but I like it when the bad guy gets, you know, caught. And I think that's what draws me to the con artists is, and I suppose that was with Craig Williamson. He never really got his comeuppance. And that drew me to him. But the other charlatans, I kind of like a good scam.
So in terms of your particular process in writing this book, because there is clearly a lot of research, a lot of work that has gone into it. I mean, how did you go about compiling the lies?
Yeah, I think that was a really interesting process. I started off when I was thinking that it was a history project, and I contacted some professors and I spoke to them, and they were actually really, really useful. And then I just started trawling through press clippings and internet searches and looked back at my own sort of history, being at a government school, a high school, and a whites-only primary school and whites-only high school, and looking at the history that I was taught and the education that I went through, and looking at those lies, Shaka Zulu, you know, everything I was ever told about Shaka turned out to be a one huge fib. Kind of going through high school in an apartheid high school, and everything that I was told was just nonsense. Going to Felt School, it was all rubbish. And so trying to kind of look at where the truth was. So that, I think, was the process of just personal and asking other people and just trying to kind of, and also looking at the present, understanding that our history is also based on what we believe now.
There's a few things in there I'm going to pick up on later, but Jonathan, what was your kind of working definition of a lie? Because it strikes me that some of the, you know, the episodes that you chronicle in your book are straightforward instances of someone saying something or doing something that is clearly dishonest or untrue. Others are sort of more fungible, I think, in terms of, like, you know, it's not necessarily a straightforward lie. It's more a kind of, a wider, more nebulous deceit. Do you know what I mean? What were you working off there?
Yeah, I think any sort of deception was very broad. So I say Hansi Kronier, he cheated. And I think that was a deception. The greatest lie, I think, was the pastor who said he could resurrect people. I mean, you know, that's a deception. So I think it was very, very broad. So I was looking at people who either, or circumstances that were either not true in some way, or there was a con involved, or something that wasn't quite kosher. So it was very broad.
Were there any lies that didn't make it in but almost did?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there were quite a number. Yeah. I mean, there's some of the kind of ones that I'd gone for sort of fun factors. The one that my brother suggested, which I really wanted to do, but then in the end didn't get round to it, was the Big Brother, the very first Big Brother house. And, there was this whole episode with Ferdy had kind of done his business in the garden. And
I vividly recall.
I'm just trying to be very sensitive. I thought that could have been quite fun. And then, because it's not, I wasn't quite sure of how much fun and how much serious. And I tried to have a mix. And I think that's what the book is about. Some are serious, some are lighthearted. But I think just generally things that are quite deceptive.
I was struck really by the volume of dishonesty that you have written about. And I was wondering, I mean, do you think South Africa is exceptional in this, perhaps this one regard? I mean, you mentioned the exceptionalism of South Africa as a one of our foundational lies. But do you think we are unusually dishonest as a people, as a country, as a society?
I don't think I think everybody lies. I think that's what I just, if there was a big sort of take home message, I discovered that absolutely everybody lies and everybody lies all the time. I don't think we're exceptional in that regard. I think maybe the nature of our lies, I think we have a lot more fun, maybe. And I think maybe our lies are quite creative. But I think we're pretty much, kind of average in I mean, if you look at some of the lies that have been told around the world, I think we're okay.
Well, that's sort of comforting in a strange way. Jonathan, you've said that there are some serious parts, and that is indeed true. I can attest to it. Actually, some very poignant and powerful parts as well. Your take on AIDS denialism, for instance, Becky's AIDS policies, the Constitution. And I also thought very brave take on Mangosuthu Buthelezi, who is obviously this hugely controversial character. Tell us a bit about that. What do you think is the gravest lie that you write about in this book?
Now, I do think AIDS denialism really, really had the most impact. And I think Thabo Mbeki has a lot to answer for. And I think that is the gravest lie. I think that actually caused the most bloodshed in our post-democracy era. And I think it's, yeah, there were a couple of chapters that made me angry, and that made me angry. And you talk about things that we've forgotten, and I'd forgotten a lot, that whole Varodine scam, you know, Becky insisting on his kind of really unscientific views, and that resulted in deaths. And I sort of kind of was a journalist covering it at that time, and it really was painful, and we shouldn't forget that. We shouldn't forget that part of our history. So I think that was the gravest lie that we told, certainly in the post-democracy period.
Mm. Apartheid, as you rightly record, was of course just a patchwork of lies. I mean, there's so much going on there in terms of what you've written about, from the Rubicon to satanic panic, etc. And the whole edifice of apartheid, of course, constructed on lies to do with racial difference, etc. You know, it often strikes me when reading about apartheid, what a very depressing period. That sounds like stating the bare minimum, but depressing not just in the way of being a crime against humanity, just these petty, small-minded bureaucrats, these ridiculous deceptions. Is that how you think of that period as well?
Oh, absolutely. On the one hand, it was almost laughable what they were trying to get away with. But of course, it was really tragic. The whole sex, you know, forbidding sex across the color bar, and how pathetic that whole thing was laughable. You know, they had the section of the police, the peeping Tom cops that were climbing up trees and looking through binoculars into windows to try and kind of catch people out. One story which I found was about them bursting in on a couple, hauling them off to the police station, discovering that actually they were both white, and it was, you know, they were just really stupid and buffoon-like, with tragic consequences. You know, they destroyed people's lives that with that pettiness. So on the one hand, it is kind of funny how stupid they were, but on the other hand, actually not so funny.
You write across a number of chapters about Nelson Mandela, founding father. Something I found very interesting, because I did not know this was a thing, Jonathan, was the conspiracy theory that the Mandela who came out of prison was not Mandela. Can you just talk us through that particular madness?
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of crazy, but it's widespread. You know, when I was looking at lies, this came up quite often, that Mandela who came out of prison was not the Nelson Mandela who went into prison. And the conspiracy goes that the real Mandela died in prison, and the person who came out was just a puppet of the National Party, and therefore negotiated, you know, well, pretended to negotiate with the National Party the end of apartheid, to give control to the National Party. And of course, there are all signs that people look to. So, for example, the 67 minutes is a sign, because the real Mandela, the conspiracy goes, died when he was 67 years old. So now we have to do 67 minutes because he died when he was 67 years old. And some people said, well, you know, when he came out of prison, only spoke English. And that's because he was actually, you know, had been trained by the British. You know, it just was kind of, but it's actually, a lot of people still believe it.
I read a study recently about how South Africans are some of the most conspiratorial people on earth. I mean, in terms of our propensity to believe conspiracy theories, we're actually way ahead of the rest of the world. I'm not sure exactly why that would be.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we're just very gullible. Maybe we like a good yarn. You know, maybe we do seem to believe anything.
We do. And then there's also the issue of our fraught history, that a lot of it is sort of unrecorded or unrecorded in formal terms, etc. Which brings me to Shaka Zulu, which I think your chapter on Shaka may be my favorite. I found it so educational because I, like you, had swallowed hook, line, and sinker what amounts to total nonsense. Let's talk a bit about that.
Yeah. So, I was given kind of impression of or this view of Shaka growing up and studying him. And we got our note sheets with the big, drawings. And this is who Shaka, and he was this, bloodthirsty Zulu warrior. I was then Googling and I discovered that there was a professor at Rhodes University, Dan Wiley, who had spent his life, well, his academic life, researching who really Shaka was and who he had been. And so what I did is I took all this view of Shaka as this bloodthirsty monster who trained these Zulu warriors by making them run over thorns and run for days, and how cruel he was. And I spoke to Dan, who has written what he calls an anti-biography, because he says there's actually very little that we do know about Shaka, and we can't write a biography. And he sort of broke down Shaka step by step and debunked a lot of actually everything that I thought I knew about him. It really was, and his take-home message was that you've got to look at the sources. You've got to look at who's saying and who's reporting these facts, so-called facts. And he had gone to the oral histories, and he had gone and looked back into what had been written, and he found some really startling information. So after you've read Bullshit, you can go and find Dan Wiley's anti-biography.
Yeah, you've really, you have sort of whetted my appetite for Shaka. What a fascinating figure. There was one particular episode that you wrote about that I have never heard about, probably to my own, it's probably a reflection of my own ignorance. And that was about Adriaan Nieuwoud and the Ponzi scheme.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. The Kubus Ponzi scheme.
What a wild story. For those listening who aren't familiar with this, can you outline the bare bones?
Yeah. So, he's still alive and he's still, I think, getting up to no good somewhere. But what had happened, I think it was in the 70s or maybe the 80s, but he started selling or asking people to subscribe to his magic cream that he was making. And what it turned out to be was sour milk. He was taking some plant and making an extract of it and getting people to buy it. And then they would make this concoction and then they would sell it back to him. And then they would then kind of get more subscribers to join the scheme. And of course, it was a classic, probably the very first Ponzi scheme in South Africa, classic Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. And people he would then send money back to them and they would sign on other people. And it just grew and grew and grew. And he made millions and millions of rand. But the thing about this was that it was quite foul-smelling, the stuff that people were making and sending back. So soon, he came from a town called Harries, I think in the Northern Cape. And soon, all these towns had this foul smell to them. But people were making money, or so they thought, until they started losing money. But because they would sell on to other people and other people would buy the starter kits, and eventually he was it was stopped. He never went to jail for that, but he went to jail for dealing in diamonds and and other nonsense. But it went overseas. So two South Africans took the scam overseas, and they also got caught by the FBI, I think they're in America, and were also jailed for it. So it was a kind of a pyramid scheme that, that had legs. But astonishing, astonishing that so many people were caught, and I think it's quite well known. I mean, I think it is quite well known by the people who were caught by it, and they've kept quiet.
I mean, it's ludicrous to think of these rural areas just like the stench of what was it, rotting milk, like this weird fermenting rotten stuff milk that everyone's trying to create and sell on. It's just a beautiful South African story, I felt. Jonathan, turning to more recent times, I was so glad that you had a chapter devoted to the pandemic, basically, because it strikes me, I mean, you in that you look at the kind of mad regulations from the government, but there was also a sense in which a lot of previously sensible people sort of lost their minds. Did you feel that way too? During COVID, I mean, I feel like that was sort of lie central, you know, all the nonsense about ivermectin and vaccines and Tim Noakes and the rest of it. That period was extraordinarily lie rich, I feel.
I think that was when I realized how conspiratorial we South Africans tend to be. And it persists. It continues. The whole, you know, I find that very depressing. I really do. The sort of the scientific evidence is so overwhelming, and is so, and yet you've got somebody who has been on TikTok or Facebook and is so dangerous. I didn't go too deep into the whole pandemic lies. I looked at the government's crazy regulations, and I looked at sort of the ivermectin saga. I found that it was just too depressing for me. Somebody I think should know better made it as one of my top liars around the whole COVID scam, COVID lies.
What is less depressing, because it's relatively low stakes, although you might disagree as someone who's clearly a big sports fan, are the multiple sports-related lies that we have played host to, from Hansi to the Comrades cheats to Camp Staldra. Camp Staldra, I mean, what a trip.
I mean, I didn't really realize the extent of what happened until I started doing the research.
Me neither.
I mean,
tell people what happened.
They shot at these Springbok rugby players. They shot at them. They put them in a pit with cold water while they seemed to be former security police. Policemen had a braai. They made them fight each other. And when I was sort of listened to quite a few interviews afterwards between some of the players talking about it, and they sort of in retrospect thought it was quite funny, although I think there's trauma involved there. It was just bizarre. I mean, they gave them a live chicken to slaughter. It's just like, these are your top rugby players, your the Springboks, the people that we worship and adore. And they treated them like kind of, I mean, it's just mind-boggling what they did.
I mean, it's just so hard to draw to combine the dots in what Rudolf Strauli was thinking. I mean, what was the reasoning? Just that it would toughen them, bond them.
Yes. So it seemed like, and also the mad thing is that this was 3 weeks or so before that World Cup. I think it was the 2006 World Cup. And I think his idea was, oh, we'll go and we'll all bond before the World Cup. And this will be this sort of kind of wonderful experience that will unite us as a team. But actually, you know, these were athletes in prime physical condition who'd been training for a year to get into shape, and then they starved them, and then they tortured them. I mean, what were they thinking? I mean, it really is the most bizarre thing.
It is loony. I mean, it's bonkers. I would love to know if that has been replicated elsewhere in the world, because that also feels very South African.
Maybe in North Korea. I don't
Maybe know. In North Korea. Yeah. Hansi. I mean, what a fascinating character, genuinely. Do you think we have any insight, even today, as to what motivated him to just squander his reputation like that?
I do think it's actually quite a sad story. I mean, it is. I think there's so much to it, and it's tragic. And I think ultimately it was just greed, and maybe we expect too much from these sports stars. Maybe we hold them up and we put them on a pedestal and treat them like gods. And then when they turn out to be flawed human beings, we blame them, which we should do, because they shouldn't be cheating. But maybe our expectations are too great, and ultimately a cricketer is just a cricketer. I loved Hansi. I loved him. I couldn't, you know. And I do remember when the scandal broke and the Indian police were making these allegations, I really thought anybody but Hansi. I thought even maybe Jonty, but not Hansi.
Yo, that's some smack talk about Jonty.
Yeah. Well, that's how I just didn't think it could be Hansi, because I would even sort of think of Jonty before Hansi. Yeah.
I mean, what drove him? Was it pure greed?
It seems to be that he just, you know, he admitted it in that King Commission, where he said, you know, I just love money too much. That seemed to be what it was about. Yeah. I think the sadness is that there was no redemption. He died before he could redeem himself, really. And I think that's part of the tragedy.
And yet went on to be, where did he finish in that notorious SABC poll of greatest South Africans?
He was in the top 10, I think. Yeah.
I think he was about sixth. What a country. You know, you say that it's sad that he, and of course it is, that he died before he could redeem himself in any way. But it did strike me that we were discussing earlier about accountability. He is one of the, perhaps the few people in your book who, you know, received some form of comeuppance, albeit quite a drastic karmic form in this case. There are a truly extraordinary number of people that you write about who I think have experienced absolutely no repercussions, correct?
Well, hopefully some of them will still receive repercussions. One of the lies, which I think it was one of the first lies that I thought of, was Jacob Zuma saying, you know, I want my day in court. Maybe there's still time.
And of course, there has been an update to one of the people you write about, which is Mr. Martis Huister.
I was quite
struck by that while I was reading the book, wondering if you guys should append a little footnote there to clarify that, there has been a development
in that way.
Have there been lies that have, emerged or been exposed since you submitted the manuscript that you would have included, do you think?
Probably.
I was thinking we've had a few more degree frauds, for instance.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they've been just huge. I think that's something that South Africans must be in the lead. We just seem to sort of can't be honest about the degrees we don't have.
Yeah, that's a real epidemic.
Astonishing, yeah.
And of course, now in election season, I mean, it's lie central, isn't it? Including whole manifestos in some cases.
Yeah, which have been apparently written by AI.
Really? I hadn't heard that. That's amazing. It does strike me that you could continue to make this sort of your full-time occupation if you needed to, just chronicling lie after lie after lie.
Yes, Although at some point I want to write about the truth. I think the book really is about the truth, but telling it through the lies. Maybe that's the way to look at it.
That's right. It's a sort of fact-checking exercise, I suppose, writ large. Jonathan, you end off by sort of ranking the liars, which must have been extraordinarily difficult, actually. What were the kind of criteria you were bringing to bear there?
Maybe one or two was my own personal prejudice. it was actually great fun to look at some of the characters that we have in our that continue to lie. Of course, Carl Niehaus had to be there for just the lies that he has told. And I also find his story quite tragic, actually, because I think at some point he was a very committed human being. Well, I suppose he's still committed, but just not to the truth. I wanted to look at who had done damage to South Africa. And so that was the list. And maybe the top liar, hasn't done as much damage as some of the others. But I just felt because of who he was and the lies he had told, and I felt he deserved his. And I think he might actually be pleased with his
with his accolade. Wondering if there's been any legal threats made. We're not going to reveal who number one is, but suffice it to say that it's someone given to making kind of litigious threats. But I'm glad to hear that that is not the case. Yeah, Lawrence van der Post, an interesting character who you write about. I suppose I don't really think of him as South African, but of course he is. And tell us a bit about on the basis on which he makes it into the list, because I didn't know this at all.
I think the person who wrote his biography said, you know, his whole life was just based on lies that he told. A very influential character, kind of quite disturbing about the bullshit that he got up to. I mean, he was a womanizer, rapist, and I think we don't know much about the side of him. I mean, he was friends with Margaret Thatcher, and he was friends with the now King Charles, but he really was a bullshitter, saying that he had been living with the San, that he had grown up with them, but it was all bullshit.
Another fine export for us as a country on the international stage. I think that possibly one of the most, you know, you were talking about the quantum of damage done. Surely one of the most kind of spectacularly destructive liars must be Nonkawuse. I mean, that is that's a doozy, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, that takes us back, and that was about the cattle killing, where she was a young girl who sort of made this prophecy: people must kill their cattle, and that led to deaths. So much, thousands and thousands of people dying. Crazy.
It's kind of up. It's sort of the 19th century equivalent of the AIDS denialism scandal, I suppose. We obviously live in like terribly polarized times and social media, etc. I was wondering if you'd received any kind of, or were anticipating any kind of blowback on the basis of, you know, the choices you've made, the lies you chronicle. I very much hope not, but I was wondering.
I think there will be. I think people are definitely going to say, you should have included this lie. This is not a lie. I think that it's inevitable that's going to happen. Of course, I would have liked to included many more lies, but you know, you have to stop at some point. And I thought 50 was a good number. But I'm, and also it's my subjective choice about what I include. And so people aren't going to agree with that, and that's okay. They can write their own books.
I mean, I must say, for what it's worth, I thought you were extraordinarily even-handed. You really make it clear to what degree this is lying is a national project in terms of, you know, age, race, gender, just everyone be at it all the time. Jonathan, thank you so much. Before I let you go, tell us what you're working on besides this. What's your next project? You always seem to have something exciting on the go.
I'm not sure yet. I don't have anything very exciting at the moment. I have a night job editing, or news editing. So that's my focus at the moment.
I'm entirely sure that it won't be many years before you bring out another wonderful book. Thank you so much for your contribution to our national discourse. It is always a pleasure. Thank you for chatting to us today on PageCast.
Thank you, Rebecca. Okay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.